It is hard for many of us who were alive during the civil rights struggles of the 60s to believe it's been 50 years since Freedom Summer, 50 years since the passage of the Civil Rights Act. To many people, it may seem like a very recent set of memories. If the memories have faded a bit, there's a book on the market that can certainly refresh them. It is called Mississippi Eyes, and it is a recompilation of photographs from the Southern Documentary Project in 1964. The project was headed by, and the book is written by, Matt Herron, our guest on The Exchange today. Matt Herron is a photographer, writer, and photojournalist. His work in Mississippi is detailed in this book, but he's also published books about his family's adventures on the west coast of Africa, and he served aboard the early Greenpeace anti-whaling trips and worked to stop the hunting of baby harp seals, among other efforts. That's just a short bio. Matt Herron, you've been busy. Thanks for joining us on The Exchange today.
Thank you, Jeffrey, for that stirring biography.
You write that after this project, we looked at the world with Mississippi eyes. Meaning what?
Well, let me read the back of the book because it says better than I could. Those of us who trained our eyes and our cameras on Mississippi had our eyes trained in turn by Mississippi. Our encounters with Mississippi taught us to look at this special place with eyes that were skeptical and questioning. What was said to us, what was seen by us, was not always truthful or actual. And when we left this place, we carried our newly trained eyes with us. From that time onward, we looked at the world through Mississippi eyes. So the cover has a young child staring at us with Mississippi eyes, but the title really goes beyond that. And I should say that the title came to me in the fall of 63 when I went to Dallas to cover the assassination of President Kennedy. Excuse me, I'm losing my voice. Sorry about that. I was in the Dallas police station when Oswald was brought through, and we were beginning to get the story that he was a lone gunman, there was no conspiracy. And I think a lot of my colleagues were accepting that, but I was very, very skeptical. And that evening I began asking myself, why am I not hearing and believing what the Dallas police are telling everyone? And it came to me that I was looking at Texas through Mississippi eyes. I'd been trained by my 2 years there to be more than skeptical. And I must say, I've carried that on throughout my life.
Was there a real... You described Mississippi as something like Mississippi Mars. It was like going to a foreign planet. So there was this... I mean, a foreign planet. A planet, you know, not this one. This sense of this fine veneer that the white society was trying to hold in place, but it really was just kind of rotten underneath.
Well, it was a rot that had endured for more than a century. And I guess I would say that the lifestyle in the South was supported on the backs of black labor. And that support had to be enforced by repression. So particularly when I first got into the state and I came into certain scenes, I had no way of evaluating what I saw. That phrase in the book came out of a time assignment I had to cover the inauguration of Paul Johnson, who followed Ross Barnett as Mississippi governor. And I came in with my time credentials, and I was essentially invisible. And I moved around looking at small-town Mississippi politicians sprouting badges that said they were honorary colonels, and beauty queens and floats watched by black sanitation workers, and it really felt like a foreign country. And I did then, as I did many times, take care of the assignment, photograph what I was asked to photograph, but I also did a lot of shooting that was more for myself and more focused on my sense that I was witnessing history. So, as I say in the book, I wandered around with my, like a secret agent, with my social documentary antenna waving furiously, shooting all kinds of special shots.
Anybody ever have an issue with that at Time or Life or Look or any of the other publications with the fact that you were doing work for them, but at the same time documenting with a cause in mind?
Well, we all shot extra stuff, and my whole take went to Life, and I assume the editors looked at it and said, "No, we're not interested in that." And what Time actually published was a very kind of neutral head and shoulders of the governor giving his speech. I don't think anybody objected to that.
All right. Much more to talk about. The pictures are quite fascinating, and I want to get into some of the specifics about these images from the gubernatorial inauguration in early 1964. Matt Herron's our guest. His book is Mississippi Eyes, the Story and Photography of the Southern Documentary Project from the summer of 1964. Welcome back to the Jefferson Exchange, and take your phone calls and emails as well. Back with Matt Herron and you in a minute 25. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is the longtime photojournalist Matt Herron. He is the author of Mississippi Eyes, the Story and Photography of the Southern Documentary Project, which he organized in the summer of 1964. Photographers scattered across the Deep South documenting the civil rights struggle, which resulted in the Civil Rights Act of 1964, the Voting Rights Act of 1965, and paved the way for a lot of changes that have happened in the years since. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange, share your own memories of that summer, perhaps, and maybe you have some experience from the South as well, as I do. The more things change, the more they stay the same. 18 years after the events in this book, I was in the South covering George Wallace running for governor once again. Join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area, in the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, by email jx@jeffnet.org. Matt, there's a fair discussion of Dorothea Lange in this book, and if people don't know the name, they'll know the picture Migrant Mother, one of the most iconic images in American photography, which she took during the Great Depression. How was she involved with the Southern Documentary Project?
Well, I was really getting started in my career as a photojournalist when I went south, but a year or two earlier, I had been in California, and I'd shown Dorothea my indifferent portfolio of photographs. And like most young photographers, I had no shame. So I took time from her, and she very graciously shared a couple of hours with me. Those were pivotal turning points in my life. Dorothea convinced me that photography could be more than just a neat profession. It could be a way of life. And even more importantly, that I could express my social concerns, my feelings about justice and human rights through my photography. I could make a marriage of the two. So when I decided in the spring of 64 to join the efforts of the civil rights leaders to bring 1,000 college students into the South to work in voter registration and freedom schools by forming a team of documentary photographers, I went back to Dorothea, told her of my plans, and asked her if she would become advisor to the project, and which she agreed to do. We met in New York. I went north to attempt to raise money, recruit photographers. She helped me in this. And so in a strange way, I think I was carrying on the tradition of documentary photography that Dorothea had so effectively championed during the 30s and 40s when she photographed the desperate Dust Bowl situations in the United States.
It certainly does seem to be a carryover from the work she did. Now, you talked about trying to get photographers and get people to help you pay for this, and you got some interesting responses, certainly in the money area. What response did you get from that former Kodak exec when you asked about maybe if you could arrange a film donation?
Well, Rochester had just gone through its own version of civil rights riots, and I think most middle-class citizens of Rochester, at least white citizens, thought that they had a very tolerant town and there were no problems. But there was, in fact, a rather seething black ghetto in Rochester. And when it erupted, people were shocked, stunned, disbelieving, and then very upset. So when I approached this Kodak executive, I wanted 1,000 rolls of Tri-X to get us started. He said first, no way would they ever do this, and then he gave me a long lecture about the fact that I should not try to upset things in the South, and maybe later, if the good Southern citizens wanted me to bring a team of photographers in, why, I could do that, but I shouldn't rock the cart. So that was one response, and I had a bunch of other responses, and I'm not a very good fundraiser. So in the end, I walked into the office of Howard Chapnick, who ran the premier magazine picture agency in New York, Black Star, and poured my woes out to Howard. And he said, well, how much money do you need? And I said, well, $10,000 would probably get us through the summer. He got on the phone and raised that in 20 minutes. I was stunned.
Wow.
And I walked out of his office with the money and the photographers I needed to get going, and it was like a sudden change in my fortunes.
Wow, that's an amazing story. We're talking to Matt Herron on the Jefferson Exchange. He's the author of Mississippi Eyes, the story and photography of the Southern Documentary Project that he created in the summer of 1964. Why Mississippi, and why take your family with you for you?
I was a conscientious objector during the Korean War, and I did 2 years of alternative service in the Middle East, actually teaching in a Quaker school in Ramallah. And I met my wife there. We came back to the United States. we started a family. And I started my career as a photojournalist. But I was also working for the Quakers in Philadelphia, and I was running peace demonstrations. I got to the point where I could organize 1,000 well-dressed Quakers with neatly lettered signs standing around Philadelphia City Hall, saying, no more war, no more atomic testing. The police were very cooperative, and it was all made everybody feel very good. A little voice spoke to me in the middle of the night and said, you're just as much a part of the establishment as the police, who are so cooperative with you. If you really believe in nonviolence, you need to go where it's really being tested, in lunch counters and on the streets in the South. So we, both my wife and I, felt very drawn to this. We contemplated moving south. Our major concern was, would our kids be safe? Our daughter was 3, our son 5. So Janine was called to Jackson to march in Medgar Evers' funeral cortege, and at the same time, her assignment was to find out whether it would be safe to move with our kids into Mississippi. She was told if we lived in a white neighborhood and were discreet, we'd be fine. And that was the only place in Mississippi where we could pull that off. So we moved. We turned out we were the only family with children to move south and join or at least take part in the civil rights movement.
And you went specifically to the Mississippi Delta. What was going on in the Delta that made it a particular focus of your efforts?
There was an interesting community in the Delta. I needed a base of operations for the summer. I had to track my photographers. I had to keep in contact with magazine editors in the North, and so I had to have a stable place to move around from. And there was a community of black farmers called Milestone in the northern part of the Mississippi Delta. These farmers had gotten land from the federal government that had been foreclosed during the Depression. And so they were had a little more security, a little more insulation from the privations that most blacks in the Delta suffered. They weren't working on plantations, they were working on their own land. And there was an interesting freedom school, voter registration effort, and a community center being built by a volunteer there. So it was a good place to end up. And I stayed in the farmhouse of a local leader, Hartman Turnbow, who was one of the most fearless men I ever met in my life. There's a story about Hartman. He was the first man to go and try to register to vote in Holmes County. And that night, some local boys came to burn his house down. Hartman appeared on the front porch in his white nightshirt in the blazing moonlight, firing away into the bean field with his shotgun. Cries of pain were heard, and pickup trucks exited the premises in a hurry. The next morning, the license plate belonging to the Holmes County deputy sheriff was found in the bean field. So Hartman went down to report the fire, and he was promptly arrested for setting fire to his own house. Or, as he said in his own version of what I consider local Elizabethan English, "I went down to the circus clerk's office and they arrested me for arsenic." At any rate, I thought that Hartman's was a good place to stay, and we had an interesting time there.
Well, you really did. There are some great pictures of some of the volunteers trying to bathe themselves in bathing suits out in the backyard of Hartman's farmhouse. We're talking about Mississippi Eyes, which is Matt Herron's book about the story and photography of the Southern Documentary Project, which he headed up in the Deep South 50 years ago. It's a great look back at some of the amazing images that came out of the civil rights struggle in the Deep South in 1964. Join us on The Exchange at 800-838-3760 around the region. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. Email jx@jeffnet.org. A couple of calls on the line. Here is Jeannie in Medford. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Matt Herron.
Hi. Thank you, Matt. Thank you, Jeffrey.
Hi, Jeannie.
Hi. 50 years ago today, I was 16 years old.
Happy birthday.
Yeah. No, I was 16 on the 50th anniversary of the Civil Rights.
All right.
And I was raised in California. For some reason, we were in Amory, Mississippi when I was 16, my family. And I walked downtown and looked at a little park. It had a railroad train and tiny little park. And I saw a sign, "My Mississippi eyes are tearing up," mm-hmm. that said certain colored people have to be out of town by sundown. I had never seen a sign like that in my life in San Diego.
Mm-hmm. All right, so this is something that must have been something you had never seen before when you first got to the Deep South, Matt Herron. I mean, the kinds of things that you would see in the Deep South then were just not part of life in the rest of the country.
Well, I remember vividly driving into Birmingham on our way south, and we'd been on the road a while, a couple days. We were tired. The kids were a little cross. And so it was a Sunday morning. The church bells were ringing. The church bells were ringing Dixie. That was the song that was pealing from the church towers.
Huh.
And we wanted to find a laundromat. We had some dirty clothes. We found a laundromat, and we were starting to walk into it, and I saw the sign on the door, "White Only." And that was sort of my introduction to the South. I said, we ain't going to wash our clothes here. Let's go to church. So we looked around for a black church, and the nearest one was the 16th Street Baptist Church. We presented ourselves at the door. We were the only white faces. We were warmly welcomed. We sat through the service, and as we did, my daughter Melissa had to go to the bathroom. So Janine took her downstairs to the facility there. And that bathroom, a month later, was bombed by the Ku Klux Klan, and four little children who were in that bathroom were killed. So, and I was back in that town right after that on assignment for life, covering the disturbances that followed the bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church. So our introduction to Mississippi was very real. It was sort of like you finding that sign in the park. Wow, what is this? How does this happen?
Yeah, it just doesn't add up to brains that haven't been around that all their lives. Matt Herron's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. The book is Mississippi Eyes, the story and photography of the Southern Documentary Project. Did anybody have any illusions coming into the South about how dangerous this work might be?
I'm not sure you really know until you're there. I certainly was frightened most of the time. After we moved to New Orleans in the fall of 64, it took me about a year to stop watching my rearview mirror whenever I drove anywhere, trying to figure out if somebody was following me.
I noticed that there are some bits of advice that you learned, like never stop moving. I mean, did you learn this advice the hard way? There's a great picture of you in the book running away from somebody who was fortunately not only armed and had a badge, but was slower than you.
And much fatter, yes. And if you look at that picture, you can almost see a grin on my face.
Yes, I noticed that.
Going to outrun him. That was that picture was taken in Philadelphia, Mississippi, when Martin Luther King came back there to lead a march a couple of years after the murder of the three civil rights workers in Philadelphia. And I knew it was going to be a tough day, so there's no camera bag banging on my hip. I had stuffed lenses in my pockets and pared down to two cameras so that I was ready to run, and I did run. What was the earlier question? Remind me.
Never stop moving and some of the other bits of advice.
Yeah. I sort of distilled four rules for shooting in the South. The first one was never be a hero. Our job as photographers was to witness what was going on, not to take part in it. So if we were arrested, lost our film, had our cameras smashed, we weren't heroes, we were chumps. Our job was to get in, get the pictures, get out any way we could, if that meant running, if it meant hiding, if it meant fake press passes or fake Southern accents or fake stories or whatever was necessary. We had to leave the scene, get to an airport, and put the film on a plane. Never Stop Moving was my learned tactic in some kind of a fast-moving situation for two reasons. If I stayed in one place, why, maybe a bunch of good old boys would decide they were going to beat up on me, but it usually took them a few minutes to get organized and get their stuff together, and by that time I was elsewhere. But also, in a situation like that, the best pictures occurred when you moved around and looked for them.
The one that I'm really most impressed by is always profess great confidence. How did you do that?
mostly by faking it. Danny Lyon drove into a small forest clearing early one morning to photograph the ruins of a smoking church that had been burned in the night, probably by the Klan. 35 black churches were burned that summer in Mississippi.
Wow.
He was getting cameras out of his car when a sheriff's car drives into the glade with the flashers going. Potentially a very dangerous situation. You have an armed sheriff and an unarmed photographer, and they're totally alone. There are no witnesses. And the sheriff obviously doesn't like what the photographer's about to do. Danny went straight to the sheriff, pulled out his credentials, and said, "I'm Danny Lyon. The FBI will be here in 5 minutes." Whereupon the sheriff pulled out his credentials to demonstrate his right to be there.
Huh. All right, so a fair amount of bluster took you a long way in this situation. We're talking about Mississippi Eyes with Matt Herron, the story and photography of the Southern Documentary Project. He headed up in the Deep South 50 years ago. Back with Matt and your phone calls and emails when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is the longtime photojournalist Matt Herron, who is the author of Mississippi Eyes, a recompilation of many of the photographs from the Southern Documentary Project, which he created and ran in 1964. In the Freedom Summer of 1964, he was based in Mississippi, coordinated the efforts of photographers across the Deep South as the civil rights struggle came to a head. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about that time in history and your own perceptions of it. And join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. Our email address, jx@jeffnet.org. Did any of the photographers, there were some injuries. You recount what happened to Dave Prince and Jerry DeMuth in Selma, in the first action in Selma at the Edmund Pettus Bridge. Did anybody else get seriously hurt in the process of documenting what happened in the South that summer?
Well, I was clubbed a couple of times, mostly at a dead run, so I wasn't injured.
You described the fact that the clubs just sort of creased your clothing in the back, and when you're running that fast, that's the way it tends to happen. That's a bunch of close calls, isn't it?
Dave had another encounter in Drew, Mississippi. He stopped for, he was working in a town known as Mound Bayou. It's the only totally black town in Mississippi. The mayor was black. The town had been carved out of some bottomland around the river right after the Civil War, when Jefferson Davis's son thought the solution to the, quote, black problem in the South would be a total separation of the races. So they found this unused land and sort of gave it to the black community. But there were two Vietnam vets who had come back to Mound Bayou and mounted their own, they brought their weapons with them, and they set up guard posts on the top of buildings at each end of the one street in the town, and sort of anointed themselves as protectors of the town. So Prince stopped at this gas station to get some gas, and he didn't realize that it was run by a couple of Klan members. While he was in the restroom, they searched his car and decided he was a civil rights worker. When he came out, they threatened him, and they said, "If you get out of town, if we ever see you again, we'll kill you." So Prince started back from Mound Bayou on backcountry roads, and very shortly he saw this Valiant coming up behind him with the two brothers in it. And they headed off at speeds, I think up to 100 miles an hour, toward Mound Bayou. And as Prince pulled into the main street, these guys knew him. He'd spent some time in a bar with him on a previous night, why the Klansmen pulled to a stop and drove off. They knew that it would be their last trip to Mound Bayou if they actually went into town. So there were things like that that happened from time to time. It was always more of a threat than an actuality, but there was a kind of atmosphere of fear that pervaded everything because you never knew when something like that might happen.
You did eventually move your family out of Mississippi partway through the summer, didn't you?
Yeah. At the beginning of the summer, my wife had the misjudgment to try to attend a White Citizens Council meeting in Jackson. She was identified and thrown out of the meeting, and then we began getting the threatening phone calls. And then shortly after that, our landlord allowed us how he was going to do a reconstruction of a house, and we should move. So I was about to start the project and didn't expect to be in Jackson anyway. Janine took the kids to Atlanta, and she spent the summer working in the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee office in Atlanta with Julian Bond, who was director of SNCC Communications at that time. So she sort of organized the darkroom, saw that prints were made, contact sheets were done, film was developed, and photographs were sent north to newspapers and others supporting us.
Let's take some calls here. We have John and Grants Pass back on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking to Matt Herron about Mississippi Eyes.
I hope your book has a little bit about sports in it. And I don't know if you're a sports fan or not, but let me just, my two cents is, there were no pro teams down there until the late 60s, so that was, obviously black players weren't going to be allowed to be down there anyway. But in college, Alabama, one of the greatest college football programs of all time, the story is that Bear Bryant, the famous coach there, went to George Wallace, the governor, who was the ultimate segregationist, and basically kind of said, we need to change. Bear Bryant knew the incredible amount of high school talent in black high schools down there, and he wanted them. And Ozzie Newsome turned out to be the very first black to ever play for the University of Alabama. So anyway, that's my to your guest. I don't know if you included sports in this, but the story of ESPN has a great series on it, the story of and stories of integration of the college athletes down there. And anyway, that's
right. Thanks for that, John. Appreciate it. Yeah, the Atlanta Braves didn't start playing in Atlanta until 1966, 2 years after this. But any mention of sports in the book, Matt?
Unfortunately, no. But I do know that apartheid in South Africa was partly defeated because the South African rugby teams and soccer teams couldn't play, would allow no black players in, and they were boycotted by the sports associations, and that was very hard for South African whites to take, and it was played a role in ending apartheid there.
Let's take another call. Here's Catherine Williams. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. Mississippi Eyes is the book. Matt Herron, the author.
Hi, Catherine.
Hello, Matt. This is Catherine Rother. My husband, Herman Rother, worked for the AFSC, and you had contact with each other back in the 60s. I just ran across a picture of the two of you at a lunch counter together.
Really?
He was in the work camp program, and it was around this time, I guess, that he went down to Tennessee with a young black man who was helping to coordinate things, and they were arrested in Tennessee for being in the same car together, and he telephoned me from the jail.
Wow. Thanks for the story, Catherine. Appreciate that. Ring any bells for you, Matt?
Well, I worked for AFSC before I started trying to become a photojournalist. So
that's American Friends Service Committee?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I do remember that, and as I was trying to figure out whether I was a true pacifist or not, I spent a summer in a Quaker work camp in Mexico, which helped me sort of focus myself. So I've always thought of myself as sort of a Quaker fellow traveler. I never quite joined the Society of Friends, but I had a lot of contact with it over the years. And when I was in Philadelphia doing peace work, it was for the Philadelphia Yearly Meeting of Friends.
When you think about the things you've done over the years, I mean, you're there because you care enough about these situations in the first place to come photograph them and to document them. How then do you complete the job of photographer without getting totally caught up as human being? I mean, how do you, for example, cover James Chaney's funeral and take all these pictures that just make you cry without even reading the captions and not end up in tears yourself?
Well, I should point out, first of all, that it was Dave Prince and George Ballas who covered the funeral.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, the copyright's right on there. Mm-hmm.
But that's a very good question, how you keep from being so drawn in you can't photograph. Really, to function as a photographer, you have to create a little space between yourself and what's happening. For one thing, there's always that little mantra going in the back of your head which says, F8 at a hundredth of a second, now open up two stops because you're in the shade. And so you're always calculating, but also in order to witness, you have to be able to see clearly. And if your motions are too involved, it tends to cloud your vision and your objectivity. So I think photographers are, to a certain extent, voyeurs. We're watchers. And yes, I was emotionally involved in the movement. I supported it wholeheartedly. But when I picked up cameras, I tried to step back a little bit so that I could observe the scene and try to do my best work. And I think you always do your best work when you're a little more involved in the visual than the emotional part of what's going on.
Were there ever cases where the emotion hit you later, though, either having a chance to go, whew, what did I just see, or seeing the prints for the first time?
Oh, yeah. In fact, it's interesting. As I went back to Mississippi a couple of weeks ago for the 50th reunion, and we heard a lot of stories, and I met people I hadn't seen for 50 years and so on. But as I review that period, it seems, in retrospect, far more dangerous than it did at the time. I was always afraid, and I could only overcome my fear when I was working. So that part of it was very real. But when I see all the incidents that other people went through and so on, and how fortunate I was to have escaped serious injury or beatings, in a certain sense, I say, wow, you know, that was more dangerous than I realized at the time. Or maybe you minimize it in order to keep going. I don't know. But
you did keep moving, and we have a great record of what happened down there as a result. Interesting thing, I was just talking about James Chaney's funeral, and you mentioned you weren't one of the photographers covering that. Dave Prince and
George Ballas
were shooting that. There was an interesting maneuver that Life magazine tried to pull to get exclusive rights to James Chaney's funeral. What was that all about?
Yeah. Well, Dave had gone in right after the murders and gotten with the Chaney family and had developed a rapport with them, particularly with James Chaney's younger brother, Ben, who was, I don't know, probably around 10 or 12. He was trying to deal with his brother's death. He was trying to deal with his no role in the family. He had suddenly become instantly sort of a subject of media attention, and he was trying to handle all this stuff. And Dave got very close to Ben. In the meantime, he was also under assignment for Life, and Life wanted exclusive coverage of the funeral. And they figured the way to do that was to get Mrs. Chaney, who is Catholic, to move the burial to another cemetery where Life could sort of maintain an exclusive watch. So they hired a local Catholic priest to go talk to Mrs. Chaney and try to convince her of that. And they tried to get Prince to weigh in on that side, too, and Prince would have none of it. He thought that was a disgusting maneuver, and Life sent a writer in, and they threatened him. They said, you'll never shoot for Life again, and he said, I don't care, and that was really sort of the one negative incident with magazines that we had during the summer. Life had put up half of the money to have us available in case, quote, something happened, close quote.
Right, and a lot certainly did. When and I know you could probably get asked this question a lot, Matt Herron. When you look at that and the 50 years that have passed since, I mean, have we gotten as far as you thought we would get, perhaps a few years after 1964?
Well, I think right after the Voting Rights Act in 1965 was passed, things moved quite swiftly, more than any of us thought. So 10 days after the Voting Rights Act was passed, there were federal registrars in every county in the South that had a history of voter discrimination. 10 days. That's how quickly the government moved. Slowly then blacks began to vote and to gain office. Today there are more black officials in Mississippi than in any other state in the Union, which is kind of surprising. So in certain ways, things did change rather dramatically. In other ways, I'm sure as you and everybody knows, we're far from a race-free society today. And police treat black kids differently than white kids, and there's still a lot of work to do. I guess my greatest optimism is when I see young people today. And I see, I think, among high school kids, much more tolerance for people of different color, people of different sexual orientation. Mm-hmm. In the long run, I'm hopeful, but we've still got a ways to go.
All right. Matt Herron, it's a fine book, Mississippi Eyes, the story and photography of the Southern Documentary Project. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it, Jeffrey.
All right. Take care. Tomorrow on The Exchange at 8 o'clock, we'll talk about a complaint about a power plant, and we'll talk about the operations of a marijuana dispensary actually open, and then we'll talk about Lyme disease at 9 o'clock with the author of A Twist of Lyme. That's all tomorrow on The Jefferson Exchange. Our producer today's engineer, Charlotte Duren. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.